All right, and we're live. Yeah, so welcome, Dr. Briggs Early.
Thanks
thank
for
you for
having
coming
me.
on Talking to Health with Logan Noon. So you are one of my professors here at the medical school, Pacific Northwest, and you've handled like all the nutritional components. So can you tell the listeners like just kind of who you are and like what your background is
in sure.
like 30 seconds sure. or less? Yeah,
30 seconds or less, probably not, but. So I'm one of the founding faculty members. I've been here since before the building was built.
Oh, I didn't know
and,
that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yep. And I was working as a clinical dietitian prior to coming here, but I had finished my doctorate through Washington State University, where I looked at like diabetes self-management stuff in Latinos and non-Latinos. And so I was living here in Yakima, had a family, all that stuff, and I was like, well, what am I going to do with a PhD now that I'm a clinical dietitian? And, you know, that doesn't really get you anything extra for having that. So I really wanted to get into academia and started seeing these billboards around town, very mysterious, with, like, the logo of the school, saying something kind of feel the dreamsy, like, you know, if we build it, will they come kind of deal. So... yeah, I contacted Bob Sutton. I don't know if you remember Dr. Sutton at all. He just recently retired officially.
Oh, okay.
And put my name in the hat, and probably 3 or 4 months later, they finally like got around to interviewing me and, you know, all that stuff. And then a while later, they offered me a position. So, yeah, I've been here ever since, and I
awesome.
Just love it.
So, I did not know that. That's kind of a cool backstory to kind of how you got started here with the school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know anything really about this school until I started applying, but I've been very happy here. I've been very welcomed, and I've never interviewed a lot of professors.
Oh, sure,
so,
I bet.
So, yeah, thanks again for kind of coming on.
Yeah.
So today's episode, we're talking about really like your life's work, your professional work, but also one of like your larger passions in your life, yoga. So I think we'll start talking about yoga, and we'll kind of finish more on nutrition.
Okay.
And really, my background in yoga, it started very... It had an interesting start, to say the least. I think I mentioned this to you before, but the first time I ever did yoga was... during my manic episode in psych ward. And I always knew what it was, but like I had that kind of stigma around it where like, oh, it's only for females, or you know, I was
have to be
kind of typical dude, I'm just gonna weightlift, you know. And I still need to do much more. I'm still very unflexible, but I've really grown to really like it. But I still don't think I practice it properly, and I'll explain that further.
Okay.
But I guess, like, when did you start getting involved with yoga? How did you develop a passion for it?
Sure. I took my first yoga class as a new graduate student over at Washington State University, and I really didn't know about it. This was in the late 90s. I started grad school in 1997, and I just had an awesome teacher who just really, like, opened my eyes to the world of yoga, and I just loved it, and I took a couple semesters. It was like an actual class for credit, you know. So I took a couple semesters of that and really enjoyed it. And then just started kind of practicing on my own sporadically here and there. And, you know, over the years, I went to a couple different, you know, public classes at different studios and things. And finally, it must have been 2012 or 2011, somewhere in there, I found a yoga studio over in North Bend. Which doesn't seem, you know, if you're listening from outside the Yakima area, North Bend is probably a good 2.5-3 hours away from Yakima. I live in Ellensburg, so it's actually only about 90 minutes away from me. But, you know, it's not super convenient to go there. But whatever the case, I found the studio just totally by, like, Googling. You know, I realized after doing yoga for a while that I really gravitated toward the kind of more alignment-based yoga, which is slower and no music and just a normal room, like not a hot room or anything like that. So it's not the trendy kind of yoga that most people are into now and have been for the good decade or more. So anyway, I started going to this yoga studio, and I just really fell in love with the teachers. They're a husband-wife couple who run this little yoga studio. It's called North Bend Yoga Shala. If you are passing through North Bend, they're really super experienced, awesome teachers. And they trained with one of the students who grew up having his yoga training from BKS Iyengar. BKS Iyengar is one of the students from this guy named Krishnamacharya. And he was one of kind of the founding people that is credited with kind of bringing yoga to the West. Patabi Joyce is another one of his teachers who's very well known because he developed the whole Ashtanga, the super athletic style of yoga. So Joyce and BKS Iyengar were kind of, you know, yoga brothers, I could say. And they just developed into different styles. And so BKS Iyengar was the guy who developed the use of props in yoga, you know, blankets and blocks and straps and all that kind of stuff. And so that's the kind of yoga that I really love. And the Iyengar yoga in the U.S., really and worldwide, is still very systematic. And if you go to an official Iyengar yoga studio, they have a syllabus. They have like, okay, our next set of courses will begin now. Like, it's like kind of taking a college course. Like, you start at the bottom and you work your way up to all the different levels. So they introduce poses in a very systematic way. And it's honestly, all of the Iyengar classes I've gone to, it's mostly older folks who like going to these classes. And I have come to realize, I think that's because once you're a slightly older person, you're able to actually just be okay with sitting in a room without talking, or, you know, there's no music going. You just have to be in a pose for several breaths. It's, you know, some people, especially I find younger folks, are not comfortable doing that. They have kind of more of a monkey brain where they're wanting to kind of jump around a lot, and they hate like being still. And that's similar to why I hear a lot of younger people, and when I say younger people, I mean a lot of medical students, tell me that they can't meditate or they can't do any mindfulness type stuff because it's too hard for them. And it's similar to that with the style of yoga that I do. So that's the kind of yoga that I do, and I ended
up... And you eventually became a teacher, correct?
Right. So I did a 200-hour teacher training through North Bend Yoga Shala, which is a two-year program. And then I'm in the middle... Well, I'm in my last year of my 300-hour training with them.
Oh, okay.
So I go over every... Well, not every, but the second Sunday of every month, and I spend all day over there and
very
do
cool.
stuff. So, yeah.
Excellent, excellent. Well, so, and why I wanted to really do this podcast with you, it's you know, it's easy to sort of like understand the physical benefits of yoga, like, you know, stretching, like it makes so much sense.
Right.
But then from a more mental perspective, like when I've been interacting with patients, and this happens mostly with like older, mostly dudes, patients, and this, it was kind of same thing for meditation. When I bring up, hey, you should start maybe thinking about yoga, like I've brought it up to my dad, and he's just going, oh, whatever, you know, like stupid hippie, like
right,
shut up.
Right,
So what is your understanding of how yoga benefits, of course, not just our physical body, but like really our emotional state of mind?
Right. There's been some really cool research studies that have been done with, in particular, Iyengar yoga. Again, because it's a pretty systematic type of yoga, I think it lends itself to research compared to some of the other types of yoga, which are much more highly variable. So they've done a lot of work on things like low back pain, where they've been able to show that people that do a certain, you know, set of poses over a certain amount of time, usually it's like 12 weeks or something, that they're able to significantly reduce their pain levels from their back pain, even though they haven't made any difference in terms of their body weight or anything like that. So a lot of times back pain studies, you know, look at like weight loss as a way to help people reduce their back pain. But anyway, so some of the other benefits aside from, you know, physical stuff are part of that expression I used, you know, that monkey brain that we have where our thoughts are kind of all over the place constantly. Sometimes people that maybe don't really label themselves as having anxiety, but they're very like jumping from topic to topic, or they're very like focused on thinking about, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow over and over again, and it keeps
or maybe
up at
like
night,
an element of ADHD in a sense.
So I think yoga can really help with that, because in particular this, I mean, I'm just speaking from my own experience, and so the style of yoga I do, it really kind of forces you to just be in a pose with your own thoughts, and you have to just kind of be there breathing in the pose and kind of soaking in the discomfort. So I think that forces your brain to really adapt and to change its way of thinking. And I have found personally, I mean, I've never, you know, been treated for anxiety or anything, but I think I've had anxiety. I distinctly remember months when I started graduate school, where my husband was actually back where we were still living at the time, and I was living in this new town all by myself. And looking back on it, I clearly recognize, like, I had anxiety for those, you know, that first year of grad school, where I was just super worried about things and really worried about my marriage and all that kind of stuff. And at the time, it didn't even occur to me to label it as anything. Of course, this is also, again, the late 90s, when I don't think these things were so commonly and as part of, you know, the zeitgeist or whatever. But yeah, I think yoga has really helped me with that. Of course, it's also hard to separate out just maturing and growing older,
yeah,
and, you know, changes that happen with that. So those things have coincided for me.
But I think yoga, I'm big into like mindfulness, mm-hmm, and meditation, and yoga,
sure,
for me, I find is one of the easiest ways that I can meditate.
Sure.
Because in those moments where essentially I'm stretched out, maybe,
right,
it hurts, or I'm,
uh-huh,
just trying not to fall down and, mm-hmm, fall on my face,
uh-huh,
you know, I'm not thinking about, oh, what residency am I going to match in? What am,
right,
I going to, when, how am I going to get prep my CV? When am I going to contact?
Uh-huh.
It's, I find it so much easier for me to like stay more in the moment, and,
mm-hmm,
maybe I start to have that monkey brain,
mm-hmm,
but versus when I try to practice meditation just sitting in a chair like this,
sure,
and just sort of breathing,
right,
though doing those stretching exercises, mm-hmm, I find so much more benefit.
Right, right.
And so you sent me a whole bunch of articles, like scientific articles on,
uh-huh,
yoga today, and one of them that I thought was most interesting was how they did this study on how doing yoga increases levels of GABA in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And GABA is one of our inhibitory neurotransmitters,
sure,
that, you know, they think that people with maybe some sort of anxiety issues,
mm-hmm,
have inefficient levels of GABA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so have you ever heard of that before? Do you have any understanding of why you think that is?
Sure. Yeah, I'm not at all a neuro person by profession or hobby, but as far as I understand it, yeah, there is a pretty strong relationship between doing things like yoga. You can also lump into there things like Tai Chi and,
mm-hmm,
and other kind of, you know, slow meditative types of practices, and the effect on the cardiovascular system. And I'm sure Dr. Raystrike maybe,
mm-hmm,
talked to you more about that. But yeah, it lowers blood pressure and it increases all of those, you know, good hormones, oxytocin and those kinds of things, I think, that are shown to be helpful and improving relationships and stuff like that.
Yeah. And well, and then so the yoga that you seem to prefer,
mm-hmm,
the most is,
yeah,
is, I guess it is an analogous to like a yin yoga, like kind of a much more still relaxation based yoga.
Maybe so. When I've done yin yoga, it's usually done in a warmer room,
okay,
and it's yeah, it's very relaxed. The type of yoga that I do, and you know, I describe it as being in the Iyengar tradition of yoga, but it's not technically Iyengar yoga because,
mm,
we are not so strict with adhering to all of those rules. So so the alignment-based yoga I do is typically done in just a normal, you know, room temperature type room on a yoga mat, but it's actually pretty physically demanding. It's just slow.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'll go through, you know, maybe 3 repetitions of, say, Warrior Two.
Okay.
And we'll hold Warrior Two for maybe a count of 10 on each side. And then we'll go through a bunch of squatting and hold that for several breaths. And we don't do nearly as much of the sun salutations as is very popular in the more flowy vinyasa style of,
okay,
yoga.
Actually, more like strenuous types of yoga, right?
Yeah, so in the vinyasa style of yoga, that's the flowy kind where you,
okay,
move real quickly through the poses.
Mm-hmm.
And in that kind of yoga, there's not really much pause in between things, and you're not really focused so much. And I'm sure people who do vinyasa yoga might disagree with me, but from my experience with it, we don't focus so much on, you know, where my foot is in relationship to my hip and stuff,
mm-hmm,
like that. In the kind of yoga that I've been trained in, we really do put a ton of emphasis on that relationship between, okay, you press your big toe mound down deep in the hip crease, you know, keep your butt lifted, you know, use your leg muscles, all that kind,
mm-hmm,
of stuff. And sun salutations aren't really even introduced until you've been doing this kind of yoga for a long time, because Iyengar's rationale was, how could you possibly do a sun salutation if you can't even do the basic foundational standing poses of yoga?
Mm.
So he really put a lot of emphasis on the whole, like, first year of this kind of yoga is just mostly standing poses. And
okay,
if you do a lot of standing poses, and what I mean by standing poses is, you know, Warrior One, Warrior Two, Warrior Three, squatting,
mm-hmm,
triangle pose, you know, side angle pose, revolve triangle, all of those things. If you're not able to do those poses, then doing sun salutations with any real integrity is pretty difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and you sent me some very interesting articles to kind of go over before this interview, and,
mm-hmm,
and it seems like the science is relatively well accepted that,
mm-hmm,
you know, yoga whatever type of yoga
yeah.
has benefits on anxiety, on
right.
depression. They uh-huh. even think it might have a benefit on like augmenting for people with schizophrenia.
Sure,
which
yeah.
I thought was extremely interesting.
I was surprised about that too, yeah.
Yeah. But uh-huh. so other things though that it kind of made me rethink like how I'm practicing yoga
mm-hmm.
because it also talked about social functioning.
Uh-huh.
And so let's kind of talk about like, you know, let's say someone's listening right now who's never done yoga before.
Sure.
Getting started with yoga, do you mm-hmm. think it's better to go to a studio mm-hmm. or like YouTube yoga kind of by yourself uh-huh. in your house kind of thing?
Yeah, I think in particular, you know, I've really kind of been gravitating this toward this idea lately, whereas, you know, we've become a society that loves to isolate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We love to eat while we're on our phone or watching television. More lately, it's on a phone or a device. We don't like to, like, sit down with friends and eat meals nearly as much as we used to. And the same thing can be said of all of the different fitness options that are available mm-hmm. on YouTube is, yes, people do them by themselves in their room. Now, if my yoga teachers were to answer this question, they have a problem with that because people are learning basically potentially dangerous ways to do things.
Hmm.
So if you do enough yoga, you know, if you're only doing yoga once or twice a week, you're probably not going to hurt yourself, and it probably doesn't matter how the relationship of your big toe to your hip is aligned. But if you're doing yoga like I am every single day for, you know, a half hour to an hour, then it's important to make sure things are lined up to where they're not going to lead to some sort of, you know, physical ailment that's going to hamper your ability to do all the things you need to do in life. So that's the real danger from our perspective when it comes to doing yoga by yourself, is that you just don't really know exactly, you know, unless you have had training already.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of interesting things people do on YouTube that I look at them and I'd be like, oi, I don't think I would encourage people to do that, especially for folks that are either otherwise really quote-unquote out of shape. So maybe they've never really done any physical fitness except walking to and from their car or something.
Mm-hmm.
So for those folks, I really would encourage them to actually go to a studio or some kind of class. You know, here in Yakima, we have the Yoga Collective of Yakima. And that's a place where people can go do free yoga classes. They're donation-based. And they're all really gentle, approachable types of yoga for really anybody, regardless of your age or your size or your ability to touch your toes or whatever. So
mm-hmm.
Places like that, I think, are a good place to start for people who are new to yoga. You know, some of the studios are really good at describing the types of classes they are as far as difficulty and stuff, but sometimes you just have to ask. So it's generally not pleasant to go into a yoga class expecting one thing and then finding out it's actually something totally different. And then you have this awkward feeling of like, should I just hang out in child's pose the whole time? Because mm-hmm. I can't do all this stuff, you know, so.
Yeah, you know, I've had, you know, when I first started getting involved with yoga was, of course, when I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and
mm-hmm.
that was 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that time I was actually working, so mm-hmm. I actually had money, unlike I do now
sure.
as a medical student. So I actually had the funds to go attend yoga classes. And prior to this conversation, I've been kind of thinking about my yoga experience,
mm-hmm.
and I think there's pros and cons to kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm not very flexible and I'm very, very novice when it comes to yoga. So sometimes I would be a little embarrassed in
mm-hmm.
a group setting.
Right.
And I know the yoga community, of course, is very welcoming, but I had that own self
sure.
embarrassment in a
mm-hmm.
sense. You know, I'll never forget there was this one moment I took a yoga class with my wife,
uh-huh.
and thankfully she's still my wife after this, because I cut a huge fart at the end of
that
it.
That happens in yoga.
Yeah, and it was very embarrassing.
Yeah.
I thought it was hilarious, but, you know, we have not done very many yoga classes together after that.
Yeah.
So we've kind of transitioned more, or me personally, just to mm-hmm. more a YouTube sort of uh-huh. based yoga.
Sure.
But what I've realized is, well, one, I definitely don't push myself as hard.
Uh-huh.
I definitely take it easy, or sometimes I'll just be like, ah, you know, I've had enough, and I'll just
right.
turn it off.
Uh-huh.
And I would never walk out of a yoga class
uh-huh.
too soon.
Right,
but
right.
then, you know, when you're sending me those studies today, how people would report in increased social functioning, mm-hmm. there is like kind of a social component
for
of
sure.
yoga.
Yeah.
And you sent me an article about hot yoga, mm-hmm. and there's of course a lot of controversy mm-hmm. with the whole Bikram thing and
right.
whatever. You know, Bikram was a piece of crap, but hot yeah. yoga itself, I still uh-huh. really, really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And especially with the hot yoga, it's like you go through that hell for 60 to 90 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And there was kind of like, I would actually find myself talking to the other classmates mm-hmm. after the class.
Sure.
And I wouldn't get that component with you know, the YouTube-based mm-hmm. yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think there's a lot of merit in that. So mm-hmm. I would encourage someone, if they are going to start, you know, go to an actual class. And
yeah.
You know, I think especially for men, there's a lot of poses that we just can't do as easily as women.
Sure.
And so how would you say, to specifically to men, to get over that sense of embarrassment?
So first off, I would encourage any men listening, there is a yoga for men class offered at the Yoga Collective of Yakima, which is just over on Knob Hill Boulevard by the Red Lion, the restaurant, Red Robin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's over there by the Red Robin, and it's very welcoming, and yeah, they have a men-only class. So the other great thing about the Yoga Collective is they have a ton of props, and that's, again, I have a bias with this, but props really allow yoga to be accessible for anybody, so mm-hmm. even if you're not flexible or if you can't, you know, touch your toes or whatever, that's why you have a block to put down, to put your hands on, so you can raise the floor and you can still experience the same exact pose, but you're not like thinking to yourself, oh, my hamstrings are killing me, you know,
yeah.
as you're doing that. It's much more approachable that way. So that would be my first thing. Second thing is, you know, if you can find a buddy to go with, sometimes things are less scary when you have a friend. So if you don't want to try out the Yoga Collective, if you want to go to some, you know, local studio, or maybe you're not in Yakima, you know, if you go with a friend, sometimes that can be more encouraging and mm-hmm. not so like, oh, I'm the only guy in the room kind of a deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just think, you know, as when I was younger, I used to work out so much more with my friends. I would go to yoga classes mm-hmm. with friends. And as I've now gotten more and more busy, you know, mm-hmm. I'm a third-year medical student. I try to do this podcast. And
sure.
I've found myself, excuse me, working out more and more alone.
Yeah.
And yes, it's maybe more time efficient for me, but like I was saying earlier, I don't work as mm-hmm. hard. It's not as enjoyable.
Right.
And so I do think that just classes in general are such a great way
yeah.
to get started. And at least from, I guess let's talk about kind of the other side of this. Like, I think what holds people back from doing classes is there's a financial component.
Sure.
And, you know, yoga studios, I know Yoga Collective is like one of the nonprofits,
right.
and they offer like a sliding scale or whatever,
it's
and that's
totally
great.
Totally free. Totally
oh, okay.
free.
And then
anybody can come. It's totally free.
But the other cool part, a lot of yoga studios do, they do like intro pricing kind
sure.
of thing, like
yeah.
you know, $10 for the first
right.
month kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And so, at least in Sacramento, I remember there were so many different yoga studios
yeah.
around
uh-huh.
that I never actually joined one. I just kept doing
sure.
intro classes.
Yes, kind of like those meal
everywhere.
Prep services. You
yes.
can try one for a few weeks and then cancel it and go to the next one. Yeah,
yes.
and get the good deal.
So I would definitely encourage
yeah.
you know, people at least start out with that.
For sure.
And I guess kind of the last question I have on yoga is, you know, what about when someone tells you, I would like to do yoga, but I'm not flexible enough? What would you encourage that person?
So sort of what I've already said, I would say, you know, come do a yoga class and just see how it is to actually use props to do mm-hmm. yoga. The Yoga Collective, and I keep mentioning it because I also teach there on occasion, but they also do chair yoga for people who, you know, are at the point in their lives where they just can't even really imagine doing standing poses. So they come mm-hmm. and do chair yoga, and we actually even have seen some younger people that like to do chair yoga just because it can be a fun way to kind of experience something different. So first off, try different, you know, studios. If you're wanting to develop your own, you know, ultimately the goal of yoga in the tradition I've been raised in is to develop your own home practice to where you can do yoga all on your own. It doesn't require any videos or anything. It's all from your head, from your own knowledge of yoga.
Okay.
But to get to that point, you have to have some experience. And so trying out a bunch of different styles of yoga is usually really helpful. You know, unfortunately, at least locally, there's pretty there's some limitations as far as what's available in terms of the variety or styles of yoga. But trying out different styles, meeting different teachers and taking classes from different teachers can be a really great way to figure out what type of yoga you like and what type of teacher you like. Some teachers, you know, teach one way, other teachers teach a different way. So that can be very helpful. The other thing I wanted to say, and I can't remember if I've gotten to your point yet, but the Blue Zones research has really shown that social interaction is super essential for health and well-being and longevity. So this idea that we as an American society have really gravitated toward these solo activities in mm-hmm. terms of eating and exercising and stuff like that, I think is really coming into clarity that we need to do more to be more social. Mm-hmm. If you look at those blue zones around the world, like Loma Linda, California, and Sardinia, Italy, and Osaka, Japan.
And can you define blue zones?
Yeah, so the blue zones are the places in the world where they have a higher percentage of normal, of people who get very old and live mm-hmm. very long, healthy lives. So they have a much higher proportion of their population that makes it to 100 and even older, and they're still in pretty relatively good health, even though they're that age. So the evidence from that work, and it's really been done kind of by National Geographic, where it's just observational stuff, but they've really shown that the not only are they eating, you know, a certain way, but they're also just physical activity is sort of built into their day, and it's usually social. So they take walks with family members or loved ones. They, you know, do Tai Chi with a group of people, stuff like that. So mm-hmm. I think that could really tell us some important information that we should consider, you know, trying to make efforts to be more social, try to spend less time being isolated. You know, if you live by yourself, try and arrange to have meals with friends, or, you know, do meal prep days where you can get together with people and do a bunch of food prep, and then you can eat meals together during the week or things like that. You know, we do have a lot of medical students who live by themselves, and so I really try and encourage people to be more social, not only for study purposes, but also for mental well-being, and they can do that through different types of physical activity. Mm-hmm. We also offer complimentary yoga right here on campus.
Yes, and I'm such a phony, you know, I've never
okay.
even gone.
That's okay.
I'm nervous because I'm like a sweaty bastard when it comes to
okay.
yoga, and like I would
okay.
have...
Yeah,
but it's still a bad excuse. There's
okay.
a shower right located 500 feet from where we're sitting right now. So I've had
several people say that if it wasn't during the noon hour, you know, I would go because I just I get too sweaty. If it was at 5 p.m., I could do it. And so
it's still a bad excuse, though. It's still a bad excuse.
That's okay.
Okay. Well, this
Dr. Selsky actually does yoga too sometimes, and he has a towel that he lays out and everything. So
okay,
you should talk to him about it.
All right, I'll try my best.
Yeah.
I'm not on campus for too much more because I start surgery.
That's okay.
Next, but it's definitely, you know, I think these are all good things, and I want to try to move away from more because I've really only been doing solo yoga mm-hmm. probably the last few years.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't even remember the last group class that I've really
sure.
been to.
Sure, yeah.
So I definitely want to kind of get back in, mm-hmm. in that regular practice.
Yeah.
So I guess let's kind of move into, like, the second thing I wanted to talk about, really, like, what your PhD is in.
Uh-huh.
Really kind of more of your bread and butter here.
Sure.
And I think, you know, if someone is experiencing depression or anxiety, mm-hmm. you know, introducing yoga isn't all that hard, you know, maybe once a week or
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Right.
But then when we talk about the component of, you know, improving your nutritional choices mm-hmm. can impact your brain, I think is much, much more challenging. Maybe
right.
you'll disagree with me.
Yeah.
But, you know, at least from my perspective, I guess my story, like, I've kind of started to think about using nutrition to help benefit my mental health.
Uh-huh.
But really, it was more in the eyes of weight loss, because mm-hmm. when I get depressed, I gain weight like no other. I stop
uh-huh.
exercising,
uh-huh.
I start stress eating,
mm-hmm.
and so that's always was kind of my motivation, is
sure.
try to losing weight and eating
yeah.
for that. But, you know, there are a lot of evidence out there that, you know, especially like folate, which is and other like B12 vitamins,
uh-huh.
Omega fats, even like an iron mm-hmm. deficiency can cause negative impacts on your health. So
right.
in your research, like how has proper eating choices impacted mm-hmm. people's emotional well-being?
Yeah, eating has a big impact on emotional well-being. And I think part of the reason people maybe sometimes what you describe might be considered, you know, you feel kind of overwhelmed maybe trying to make all the right choices. And I think that stems for a lot of people from again, kind of a society issue that we all suffer from, where we have a lot of all or nothing thinking. So a lot of people that I run across in my time working with patients, and also just, you know, as a person and working with medical students too on these issues is a lot of people like to either do everything 100% perfectly or not at all. And they hate being just kind of middle of the road. So what I really like to encourage people to do is to, number one, try and stop that kind of thought pattern. Instead, try and just make one or two changes to the way you're eating. So a lot of people will tell me, you know, well, Dr. Lee, this is, you know, what I ate yesterday, and I know it's terrible, and I know I shouldn't eat chips, and I shouldn't eat ice cream, and, you know, I need to eat breakfast, and I drink too much caffeine, and they just have this laundry list of things that they know they should change, but they don't know how to do it, so they don't change anything. So what I try and get them to do is just to identify one or two of those things that they feel comfortable working on, and really try and focus on just progress on those one or two things. So for some people, you know, maybe they eat too much fast food, but maybe they also skip breakfast. Maybe they also never eat fruits and vegetables. Maybe they also, you know, drink a ton of caffeine. So I wouldn't tell them to change all of those things. I would suggest that they pick one or two that they feel like they could really take on. Mm-hmm. And for some people, the fast food thing is super convenient. It works for their budget, and they feel like that's what makes them be able to get home and see their family and still study and all that other stuff. So maybe that's not the one that they pick. But maybe the fact that, you know, maybe they have a significant other at home that would be willing to help them kind of prep some fruits and vegetables for snacks during the day or something. Mm-hmm. So that might be something that they pick to work on. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. You're increasing your fiber intake, you're increasing all your good micronutrient intake by eating more fruits and vegetables. You're not significantly changing your energy, your caloric intake. And in some cases, if you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, you might actually decrease your quote unquote unhealthier calories from other foods just because you're not as hungry. Mm-hmm. So trying to get people to focus on just small changes that can make really significant impacts in their overall wellness, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, I think that's a good attitude. And it kind of also reminds me, then do you advise your patients, like, what do you think of cheat days or cheat meals?
Yeah.
Or like, what do you... That helped me with my weight loss journey. I'd always have, like, Friday night, I would just go kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But from your professional perspective, what do you think of that?
So I'm very much a person that likes to try and figure out whatever works for that person. So some people definitely need that kind of flexibility where they have to have that. You know, in my experience, those tend to be the people who like things like intermittent fasting, where they can work really hard to be super strict with themselves one or two days a week, and then the other times it's not so much. It's kind of fair game. So, you know, I personally don't follow that type of approach, but for some people they really swear by it and they like it and it works for them. So I'm all about whatever works for that person as long as it's, you know, safe and reasonably effective and not costing you a ridiculous amount of money.
Okay.
So, yeah.
You mentioned intermittent fasting.
Uh-huh.
And so I want to get your perspective from, maybe it has its pros and cons from just a purely nutritional standpoint, but I want to talk more about kind of the emotional component, because I've tried intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
And I've gotten just so hangry and irritable.
Yeah.
And so... from an emotional standpoint, I think it's a horrible idea. Some people say that goes away over time. So so what do you think?
Again, some people are more sensitive to that. I'm in your camp. There's no way I could do intermittent fasting. I think the bigger problem is that, again, I'm making sweeping generalizations about our society, but based on the public health knowledge I have, we have a tendency as a society to do tons of snacking and lots of later in the day eating. So most of our calories are consumed after, you know, 3 p.m. So if you think about the way that we quote unquote used to exist, you know, it was, and I'm not talking necessarily like hunter-gatherer type, but a little more into the recent future where we ate kind of three meals a day, okay? And now we have morphed into this society where people, I think, are more likely to skip breakfast, sometimes skip lunch, or they'll just grab something quick and small, eat a really big calorically dense dinner, and then also eat some sort of snack after dinner, bedtime snack slash dessert, whatever you want to call it. They go to bed really late. They don't sleep well because they have all this stuff going on in their head, keeping them awake. and then they get up and do it all over again. So they're not really technically ever having that kind of 12-hour, 10 to 12-hour overnight fasting period, which we used to always have. So if you eat dinner at 6 and then you get up at 6 in the morning and you don't eat anything after dinner, you've basically set yourself up to get about 11 to 12 hours of a quote-unquote fast. And a lot of people don't do that anymore. So I think it would be interesting to compare groups of people. I don't know if somebody's already done this study. Intermittent fasting research is not my thing, but it would be interesting if people took, you know, two groups of people and they had one group just eat 3 meals a day and then go from overnight for 10 to 12 hours of a normal, like, I'm sleeping so I'm not eating kind of a thing, and then compare that with the intermittent fasting group and see how those compare. I don't know if they would be dramatically different, but I agree that I think it's really hard for a lot of people to go more than like 12 hours without eating.
I've given up. So yeah. I'm trying to go more just caloric deficit, but even then I really struggle. Sure. So you mentioned kind of eating late at night.
Yeah.
And so doesn't that, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't it, if you eat late at night, doesn't it impact your sleep and your quality of sleep?
Yeah. You know, depending, again, from a research perspective, I haven't read specifically about this lately, so I can't quote the evidence for sure. But from what I recall, the last time I looked at this a few years ago was, yes, people who eat later in the day typically have worse sleep patterns and worse sleep habits. And they're also usually consuming just as much, if not more, calories, even though they're skipping eating in the earlier part of the day. Because a lot of people will tell me, well, I'm not hungry when I wake up in the morning, so I don't eat until, you know, 3 o'clock or 5 o'clock or whatever. But they still eat the same amount of calories. It's just in a much more condensed amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I guess before we kind of get in, start telling people what they should eat, some of the articles you sent me had some really interesting data in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was one article that said adolescents that eat primarily junk food are 79% more likely to experience depression.
Sure.
A diet high in trans fat is 42% more likely to experience depression.
Mm-hmm.
There was a study that looked at students at Appalachian University, and most specifically males who consume less fruits and vegetables experience more depression.
Yep.
People who have a higher sugar intake also experience much more anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other component that wasn't at all surprising to me is food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know where your food is coming from, you're going to feel very anxious and depressed.
Mm-hmm.
That all makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
But then it's kind of like, well, what do I do with this information?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've taught us a lot in these last, you know, 3 years of educating me about the Mediterranean diet.
Mm-hmm.
I feel we've mostly learned more from a cardiovascular and endocrine perspective, you know, trying to improve diabetes and reduce cardiovascular disease, all of that.
Uh-huh.
But not so much from a psychiatric standpoint.
Sure.
But lo and behold, the Mediterranean diet has actually been proven to reduce depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So for the listeners out there who don't know what the hell a Mediterranean diet is, can you explain to them what it is?
Sure. So Mediterranean diet is based on the eating patterns of people that live around the Mediterranean, so south of France, Italy, Croatia, you know, those areas. And really, it's based on a lot of fruits and vegetables. I don't know if there's a specific number, but I'm just picturing the Mediterranean food pyramid in my head. So it's on a base of fruits and vegetables, also whole grains and legumes. And then the second layer is things like fish, and what else?
Oysters, I know, is in there.
Yeah, seafood in general, fish and seafood in general. And then at the very top are things like, you know, well, I guess they have eggs and dairy in between there. So they eat some eggs and dairy. And then above that is stuff like red meat. And then at the very, very top is stuff like actual, you know, processed sweets and things. So they often use fruit as a dessert item. They eat things like yogurt with fruit as a dessert type idea. And they just don't eat a lot of processed stuff. So if people are eating bread or pasta, it's often homemade or it's really, really fresh and whole grain type stuff a lot of times. Well, pasta's not, but yeah, and the other thing that they're doing, again, trying to reiterate what the Blue Zone stuff does, is they're very social. They get physical activity just as part of their day. And they usually also have some alcohol sprinkled in there.
Hell yes.
With the meals though, not okay. Just alone.
Not yeah. Except that's not okay. No, I'm
yeah.
Just playing.
Yeah.
But so my other question though is, you know, let's say someone, like you said, you don't have to be perfect when you're
right.
Following a Mediterranean
mm-hmm.
diet, and I think that's great advice.
Yeah.
But you know, let's say someone is starting to have deficiencies in certain, maybe like a folate vitamin
mm-hmm.
or maybe vitamin C or any of, there's 12 different vitamins and other minerals that was listed in this article
sure.
that have benefits on mental health.
Uh-huh.
What are your opinions on, like I remember you did a lecture on this, on omega acids.
Uh-huh.
Eating these omega fatty acids
uh-huh.
versus taking a supplement.
Right.
What are the differences there?
Right, so this has been kind of a long-standing thing in nutrition where, you know, early on they tried to replicate the outcomes they were identifying in people who ate these diets really high in fruits and vegetables, and they were trying to basically supplement, provide all of those nutrients in supplement form, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, the B vitamins, the vitamin C, all of some of the minerals, stuff like that. And they were not, they've never been able to create the same outcomes. And they think this is partly due to all of the different phytochemicals and fiber and things that they can't really quantify so much, and they certainly can't put them in a supplement. So that's the main reason that supplements aren't really recommended over actual food that contains those nutrients. Specific to the omega-3 fats, that they have specifically looked at people who eat, you know, like fatty fish X number of times a week, or they get so many servings of omega-3 fats in their diet on like the PREDIMED trial was one where they had like actual olive oil, like a certain volume of olive oil they had to use throughout the day, like every day of the
mm-hmm.
week or something. And they compared that to people who actually got fish oil supplements. And again, they weren't able to replicate the same exact kinds of findings. So the whole food is always the better option
okay.
From a nutrition perspective. And I really like to emphasize fiber, and you can't really get fiber unless you're drinking like a ton of Metamucil or something. And
okay.
it's usually a different type of fiber that you're getting too. You know, the fiber we find in food is usually a mixed type of fiber. It's a mixture of soluble and insoluble fiber. So I think that's really important to keep in mind, especially for, again, things like psychosocial or mental health issues often go hand in hand with conditions like IBS, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so people that have IBS can be really sensitive to certain types of foods. And if you really have more food-based nutrients and food-based fiber, that's usually a better way to go for those conditions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple more questions. So, you know, and this is, I guess, my own personal question.
Uh-huh.
So I've always been a little overweight. You know, so when someone's trying to lose weight, you, of course, have to create a caloric deficit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, burn more calories than you take in.
Uh-huh.
But I feel whenever I get in that state, I have that irritability mm-hmm. component
right.
where I just get hangry, like I was talking
sure.
about earlier. So how do you advise your patients to handle that?
Yeah. So you might remember from one of the times I provided a lecture, because I think I say this at every opportunity, is that you really have to be thinking about the goal when it comes to weight loss. So for some people, they're really hung up on, and I think this is safe to say it's more common among females than males, but some of us get really hung up on body image
mm-hmm.
and we want to be a certain size or we want to look a certain way. So that's really the emphasis of our weight loss efforts. If on the other hand, we're more focused on health outcomes, you know, we just want to feel better. We want our knees to ache less because we are carrying around less weight, stuff like that. Those usually require very different approaches, and they usually have very different results. The person who's really focused on body image or body size or size of clothing they're wearing
mm-hmm.
or those kinds of things are usually going to have to be much more dramatic in their efforts to lose weight, as far as reducing their intake more dramatically, increasing their energy expenditure more dramatically. But the people who really are focused on the health benefits of those things are usually able to be more reasonable. They're probably not seeking to lose a ton of weight, but maybe just 5% of your total body weight over, you know, a reasonable amount of time, like several months. And that can usually be more sustainable in the long run, so you're less likely to have those big changes in
mm-hmm.
weight over the years, which has been shown to be detrimental to us. So if you're able to have just a little bit of weight loss, you know, 1 to 2 pounds a week, which is not at all exciting, as I've said before. I try and say this to all of the students who go through my stuff. As humans, I think we love excitement and things that are flashy and exciting. And so,
well, and seeing that big drop on the scale is such a good feeling.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And so things like fad diets that are very like new or cool, or, oh, I have to buy special food for it, or, oh, I'm following this diet written by this famous person or whatever. All of those things are exciting to us because, again, we have these monkey brains and we like to be distracted by things. But moderation in all things really is important. Mm-hmm. So, and ultimately, I think if you look at most of the evidence, it shows that people who follow very moderate but healthy lifestyles are more likely to have better long-term outcomes in the long run.
Okay. So, two more questions that I want to fire at you. So, you know, a big objection I always hear, and I've even said it myself, you know, oh, I don't have time to eat healthy because I don't have time to get to the store. I don't have time to cook. Mm-hmm. And I do think I actually made a meal the other night, and I realized there's so much personal satisfaction in cooking your own food.
Sure.
And I do think that there's a lot of merit to doing that.
Right.
But what is your opinion on these companies like Freshly, like Blue Apron or other, you know, and if the listeners don't know, it's like you can, they like send you a box with all the materials to cook.
Right.
And so what do you think of those solutions?
So some of them are healthier than others. I actually just compiled a list of those the other day for somebody who I was trying to help. And, you know, I really encourage people to look at your food budget, and especially people who eat a lot of purchased food, like pre-prepared food. I really encourage you to add that up and look at what that adds up to compared to one of these meal what are they called? Like meal prep plans or meal delivery services?
It's like you still cook it yourself, but they send it all like prepackaged and everything. I've personally never done it.
Yeah.
It seems pretty cool though.
Yeah. So me and my family tried one. We tried the Green Chef one, which I think is an organic thing. And we really loved it. I was super impressed with how healthy their meals were. The thing that I have a problem with because of where we live is the amount of waste that all of it produces. Like, I just couldn't stomach it. It was too much packaging. And because living in a small town, we can't recycle all of that type of stuff like you can if you live in a big city. So we didn't continue it. But they are super, you know, at least that company is really, they emphasize a lot of, you know, greens and whole foods and all that type of stuff. So I was really impressed. I loved the recipes. They were super tasty and they were really easy to put together. And it made me feel like we had kind of made a kind of a fancy meal, but even though we didn't, you know, it didn't take a ton of time. So I really like that. I just don't like the waste aspect. That's kind of against my environmental roots, I guess. Mm-hmm. But there's several other companies like Purple Carrots, another one that tends to be more vegetarian, vegan for people who want to try the plant-based thing. There's Sun something. That's another one that's, again, kind of more plant-based. But there's a whole bunch of them. I'm happy to send the list that I put together the other day if you want to share it with people. But I think, especially if you can sign up during the times when they have deals, they always have sign-up deals for people. And now there's so many different companies available, you really can, like, rotate through different companies and try them out. You just have to be on top of it. Like, you have to cancel your subscription and stuff like that because, you know, of course, if you forget, they'll just keep sending it. But I have some colleagues that totally love those services. They feel like it makes them feel like they're eating, you know, decently nutritious food. Mm-hmm. Even though they don't feel like they have time to cook, or they just maybe just never learned to cook and they don't have any interest in it, but they still want to eat good food. So if you can afford it, because it probably is more expensive than buying actual food.
Yeah.
But for people who eat lots of meat, I would argue it's probably actually not that much more expensive, depending on which option you go with.
I do eat a lot of meat.
You know, meat-based diets are pretty well recognized as being more expensive compared to more plant-based diets, because you can get things like legumes for, you know, pennies on the dollar compared to like
steak.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm never going to give it my steak. It's just too good.
No,
but,
that's
okay. So I do want to definitely try some of those services, because I find when I go to the grocery store, I'll try to buy healthy things, but I feel though I end up not cooking all of the vegetables that I buy or something. So then I end up generating waste in other means that, yes, it's biodegradable, but whatever.
Yeah.
So, okay, last question. So we haven't mentioned, I feel like probiotics is like a big thing we always hear about, how the gut biome is potentially related to how we feel in our brain.
Absolutely.
So what is your opinion on people taking like probiotic supplements or eating to get a proper gut guy?
So first thing on the supplements, we have a gut microbiome, and if you look at a healthy gut microbiome, it's hugely diverse, you know, billions and billions of different types of things and organisms. But the supplements you can take, there's only a few of those that are in a container. The other problem is shipping and storage. They've done samples on products that you buy at the store where you think you're buying so many, you know, colony forming, whatever it's called, I'm not a microbiologist, groups of that microorganism, and then they sample them in the lab and there's hardly any in there, or they all died or whatever. So I really caution people against buying probiotic supplements just because of that issue, really. And really, if you just eat more fruits and vegetables, you are getting more more healthy bacteria in your gut.
Oh, okay.
The natural way.
Okay, keep it simple.
Yeah. Exactly. Keep it simple and just be kind of light on washing your vegetables and you'll get even more.
Really? Yeah. Interesting. Okay, I'll have to make sure my wife hears this. She's like, you didn't wash it enough.
Okay, I definitely encourage people to wash things that are not organic, but if you buy organic produce, I mean, yeah,
just eat it.
Give it a rinse, but yeah.
Nice. Well, great. That's about 50 minutes. Any last final words of advice on either yoga or nutrition for our listeners?
No, just, you know, it doesn't have to be all or nothing, and a little bit of anything you can do is better than nothing.
Hell yeah. Okay, well, great.
15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Wait a minute. I've heard that before. That's the note Jeremy wrote to me in my yearbook in the sixth grade. How'd you even know that?
Because it's from Geico.
Yeah, wait, here it is. Dear Luke, have a great summer. P.S. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more. Love, Jeremy.
Geico's had this tagline for years, because we help save people money.
So wait, you're saying Jeremy copied you? Yeah, that actually does sound like something the J-Man would do.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
BetMGM welcomes you with a special offer on the NBA. Simply place a $10 moneyline wager on today's game. If either team hits a three-pointer, you'll win $200 in free bets, regardless of your wager's outcome. Just use bonus code CHAMPION200 when you make your bet. BetMGM is proud to be an authorized gaming partner of the NBA, and there's endless ways to make it rain with the king of sportsbooks. Download the app or go to BetMGM.com and use bonus code CHAMPION200 to win $200 in free bets if a three-pointer is made in today's game. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. 21 years of age or older to wager. Washington, D.C. and Virginia only. New customer offer. All promotions are subject to qualification and eligibility requirements. Rewards issued as non-withdrawable free bets or site credit. Free bets expire 7 days from issuance. Please gamble responsibly. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-522-4700.